This is the IBJ podcast for the week of June the 10th, 2021, brought to you by Resultant, formerly KSM Consulting. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Sharp listeners might have noticed last month that I was on vacation for a week. It was more of a staycation, and I did what I traditionally do when I get a week off. I vow to finally get my family's finances in order. And here's what that means for us. We want a cohesive and comprehensive financial plan that will point me and my wife toward retirement, just as our son is heading off to college, which is not the world's greatest timing, and is still a ways off. God willing, it'll happen. We want all of our investments to be working together to point toward that goal, and we want the proper tax planning and insurance products to protect us along the way. Every time I embark on this journey, I get stuck. And where I usually get stuck is in choosing a financial advisor to help us do all of this. I get overwhelmed by the vast array of options available to help with this kind of work. And, you know, probably the biggest hurdle is that I am cheap. As they used to say, I don't want to pay a lot for this muffler. There are a lot of ways to compensate a financial advisor, and I want to make sure I get good bang for my buck without draining too much of the money that I would rather have in my account, accruing value over the next 15 or 20 years. So, after failing yet again, I have decided to stomach my pride and bring this matter up to IBJ personal finance columnist Pete Dunn, who we all know as Pete the Planner. Earlier in his professional life, Pete was a financial planner before dedicating himself to a wider ministry, if you will, of educating folks about an even wider gamut of financial issues and financial wellness. Now, I found this conversation very helpful, and I hope there's something here that you'll find educational as well. So here it is, our conversation. As always, I'm pleased to welcome back to the podcast Pete Dunn. You know him as Pete the Planner. How are you, sir?
Mason, I am fabulous, and I'm excited to be back with you. And I mean that. That sounded insincere, but the joy is present in my heart and soul.
Can I say that it is always a bit bittersweet for me to meet with you, because I can see how your physical fitness program is working out. And I mean, you look great.
Thank you. And I have to admit, I put on this shirt this morning that I've not worn in a couple years. It's a golf style shirt. I have to admit, it's a little tight in the arms. That felt really good. And I made my wife feel my arm this morning.
So anyway, we have talked off the air, as they say, but I'm going to get right into this, knowing that you know basically what I'm about to bring up. Here's the deal. My family has a financial issue that I find incredibly confusing and have found incredibly confusing for many years, and so confusing that I really haven't done anything about it. And I really should have. And it's amazing that my wife has not beaten me up about it more than she has. I'm going to bring it up with you today in hopes that it will be instructive to some people. Some other people may be in a similar situation. Here's the basic deal. So my wife and I suspect that we are in a place now where we need a financial advisor, right? We got married. We had several different kinds of financial assets that got lumped together. We have two 401ks, actually three, because I got one from an old job. IRAs, mutual funds, ETFs, shares of stock in public companies, and so on and so on. We've got a really good amount of cash. We have enough cash for maybe a year's worth of living expenses. We have so much cash that sometimes I wonder maybe, you know, we're leaving some money on the table. Maybe we should be investing some of it. We have a college savings plan for our five-year-old. My wife has an insurance policy that is worth like three times as much as my insurance policy. It's just a big mess of stuff. It's not in any way, you know, cohesive. There is no plan. We want to have a cohesive, comprehensive financial plan. We assume that we need to have a financial advisor to do that. And where, I mean, I think both of us really get hung up, and this is kind of a preview of the main issue for me, is deciding how much we're willing to pay for these services, right? I mean, a lot of the options that we have investigated, even a couple of people that we've interviewed, they come with annual fees based on the value of our investments. So, I mean, some folks probably are familiar with this. Usually it's in the neighborhood of like 1% of the assets that your person is managing. So if you had $500,000 in investments that could be managed by an advisor, we'd be paying $5,000 a year. And then when I do the back of the napkin calculation for the total fee that we'd be paying over maybe the next 20 years, it's easily like $100,000. And that's just sticker shock for me. And that's about the point where I lose consciousness.
Yeah, I'm so excited for this very special 3-hour edition of the IBJ podcast. I need to get a couple disclaimers out there if you're okay with that. I am not a financial advisor who takes on clients. We are a corporate financial wellness solution. So no one call me because I'm going to give you amazingly witty and informative answers today. Like, I'm not looking for client. I don't do that. So that's not the point of this episode. It's to help you understand as a former financial advisor, how are you supposed to cut through all this information to make good decisions for your family? So Mason, is that a fair disclaimer?
That's great.
Okay. It's metaphor time, ladies and gentlemen. So you've got a bunch of ingredients in your kitchen. Like, I'm sure you got some staples like flour and sugar. You may have some fresh foods in your fridge. You may have some canned foods. You may even have some meats in your deep freeze or something like that. It's just a bunch of ingredients, much like all of those financial words that you used a couple minutes ago. We have an ETF. We have a mutual fund. We have too much cash, which is a phrase I love to hear people say. We have too much cash. Oh, what a problem.
I know. I honestly love having too much cash, just so you know. It's going to take a lot to get me away from that cash.
It's a very cringeworthy problem to have. It's like, I know. So how's it going? Oh, too much cash. We got too much cash. Yeah, times are tough. No, anyway, so you've got all these different ingredients, but I would argue, number one, they don't necessarily make a dish that you would want to eat. Number two, you don't necessarily know how to make that dish. And number three, that dish may not actually be healthy for you and productive as a choice. And so that is why the entire industry of financial advice exists, is to show people what ingredients to buy, how to technically make a recipe, and then choosing the right recipe to make in the first place, which is the overarching strategy. So as you and I begin to pick this apart, or an advisor gets involved to pick it apart, we have to understand what real tasks, what real jobs you need performed by an expert. So that's where our conversation will begin, is trying to say, do we need people to evaluate your ingredients? Do we need people to teach you how to cook? Do we need people to tell you what to cook? So that's where we'll begin.
Oh, okay.
So do you think you have good ingredients? Let's start there.
I like, you know, the base of this dish that I've got.
Okay.
I mean, it's good. I got, you know, I'm a, as we mentioned before, I'm a 53-year-old guy with a 44-year-old wife. We're both employed. We have a pretty good amount of money. It's in the six figures.
So my question to you would be, you know, prior to the show, we were just chatting a little bit, and you mentioned at some point in time, you went to a financial advisor and their solution was to get rid of all your ingredients, buy all new ingredients, and then they're going to charge you to make the meal, right?
Yes.
So when you heard that, obviously you were hesitant because you didn't want to necessarily pay the fee, but you were also naturally skeptical because what that person said to you is, Mason, I see you've got this big basket of ingredients. Turns out none of them are good.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah, that's hard to hear. And it really forces you to say, is this person being honest? What are the chances that every ingredient in this particular basket isn't good? That just seems like a lazy assessment from an outside individual, from my opinion.
It did to me. And certainly that, you know, objectively, I mean, to the extent that I can read a financial statement and see, you know, how some of these investments, not all of them, but some of them have, you know, accrued value over like the last decade, I know they're good. I'm getting, you know, maybe 10 to 12% a year return on some of these funds that I have. And I'm like, I love these funds. I feel like these funds are part of my family. I don't want to get rid of these funds. They're doing great.
Yeah, sometimes what ends up happening is a financial advisor will get involved in a situation like this and they will tell you to get rid of an ingredient or an investment. How long will I keep this metaphor up is the real question here.
Keep going.
They'll tell you to get rid of an ingredient because they don't know how to cook with that ingredient. And so they'll either do it out of practicality. They'll say, look, I just don't have familiarity around this. So if I'm going to advise you on how to make recipes, I don't even know what yucca root tastes like, right? I don't know what this tastes like. How am I supposed to make something out of it? Or it's also could be out of laziness and convenience that they just say, well, hey, just switch to this one because somehow I'm more incentivized financially to make you do that. So that's one of the elementary challenges that I think you're having, is that you have already had someone be completely dismissive of your ingredients, and you are hesitant that your next interaction will bring you the same experience. So here's the thing with that. And I also, I forgot my other disclosure I needed to make. Yeah. I'm very pro financial advisor. I think most people should have some financial expert in their life. And I wholeheartedly believe that. I have a financial advisor. It's something you should do. However, my biggest pet peeve in financial advice today are all the commercials that say, we don't have cookie cutter solutions. We have a custom portfolio for you. Okay, not everyone needs a custom portfolio. It's absurd. The reason, you know, those meal kits like Blue Apron are so successful is, you know, if someone's like, well, I don't like shallots. It's like, you know what? Pipe down, Gary. This recipe has shallots in it and it's going to be delicious and you're going to like it. And he eats it and he loves it. There shouldn't be custom solutions to most people's portfolios because there's only so many ways to lead to a successful outcome. So I don't know. I'm not discrediting, you know, what you value, but I would also argue, hey, if it ain't broke, don't try to fix it. If this strategy of managing someone's money works, then maybe that strategy just isn't for you if you want to hold on to the ingredients that you like. So we can eliminate that type of advisor from your search.
Now, I want to back up because I did have like a series of questions that do make sense in sequence, I think. Number one, am I correct in assuming that I do need a financial advisor? How does somebody know? How does the person listening to this podcast know they need a financial advisor?
All right, so I'm going to answer the question both generally and specifically. We will start with generally. Yes, most people at some point, there's a pretty big caveat, need a financial advisor because they just don't have the level of expertise they need to know how things fit together. Okay, that's just the truth. I will also say part of that general recommendation is you need to have financial vehicles, mutual funds, investments, insurance, savings, to justify the expense to have someone help you with it. Not a lot of financial advisors are really there to take people who have absolutely no assets and turn them into wealthy people. Like, that's not a thing. That's wild, but that's not a thing. Now, the other specific reason you, the legendary, often locally recognized Mason King, need a financial advisor is because when you just went through your ingredients list with me, it was almost overwhelming to hear. It was probably a little bit overwhelming to both say and then consistently think about. So that's to say, I don't think you know how those things fit together or should fit together. And that's why you absolutely need someone giving you some guidance.
Now, I want to ask about terminology, because the first thing you do when you search this stuff on the internets is discover that there are all kinds of different people with different titles that do some or all of this. As best as I can tell, financial advisor is a blanket term, but you could just as easily be find yourself looking at financial planners or investment advisors or financial consultants or wealth managers. There you go. I'm confused.
I think there are two primary areas of how to evaluate what a person actually does. There's investment advice and then there's financial planning, right? And so what's weird about that is that insurance, which is often thrown into the mix here, is actually a financial planning service. However, because of the nature of permanent life insurance, how some people choose to both use it as an investment and some people love to recommend it as an investment, it blurs the lines between, is this financial planning? Is this investing? Can it be both? And how does it interact? So I think as I listen to you, I'm not so sure so far that you need investment advice. I think you need financial planning advice. And I think that's where the difference begins.
Okay. Well, that was one of the questions that I had down the line was, yeah, whether or not this is something that could be split in two.
It can be burdensome to split it in two, although it seems like you're going to somehow save money if you split it into two. I mean, I would start with someone doing a full financial assessment of your life, and that requires you to trust them, right? Which is a whole other 40-minute spiel that you and I could go on, right? But it requires you to turn yourself over to them and say, what do we got here? What do you think about this? And if you got the right person, what they may say is, you know what? I don't love your investments, but they're fine. Let's work on the strategy of everything else. Like if you were to hear that, That is the unicorn of financial advisors. You know, it's like, look, I could probably make some money shuffling this around, but let's not waste our energy and time doing that. Let's spend your money, the fee I will earn, by putting together a financial strategy. That is ideal.
Well, you know, what I've heard in conversations with some professionals, what I regularly hear is, I can beat the S&P 500. That's a bar, that's a standard. Like, I can do better. I can get you better value than you could if you just invested in a S&P 500 fund.
You know, it's funny that midway through our conversation, we somehow always come to the place we should have started, which is, theoretically, you need to decide as an investor, Mason, whether you want to beat or be the S&P 500. And I think that informs your decision going forward. You didn't ask, but you're going to. My personal strategy, me, Peter Dunn, not Pete the Planner, just a random balding Midwesterner, is to be the S&P 500. I have no desire, secret or otherwise, to beat the S&P 500. Is it occasionally nice to get better returns? Sure, but I don't outwardly seek that. And I think that's where this conversation really begins, because if you're trying to beat it, then you have to generally pay to beat it. If you don't care to beat it, if you care to just sort of match it, even with a more diversified portfolio that lowers the risk, then you don't necessarily have to pay as much. That's my opinion.
Well, and then some of these investments, like a 401k or a mutual fund that is indexed to the S&P, I mean, you're locked into that investment strategy that is built into that fund. Like, I'm in a target date fund at work that assumes I'm going to retire in, I think, 2040. And so, you know, the risk that fund takes, you know, is appropriate for somebody my age. And it's like, whatever, 15% bonds and 85% equities. So I'm locked into that whether I like it or not.
You are, but here's where this takes on an added layer of complexity. Let's say you take all of your retirement investments, whether it's in your 401k or anything else, and you look at them in aggregate and you say, what's my allocation? Like, what's my total aggregate allocation across anything I would touch post 59 and a half years old, right? We call that qualified money in the business. What you might find is that you're intending to have one risk tolerance. You're intending to have one asset allocation strategy. But when you look at those funds in aggregate, it's incredibly misallocated, right? Because you've got more money in one account with a set target date strategy, and then a different amount of money that maybe has a more aggressive strategy. And when you put it all together and you were to just look at it and say, oh, is this something I would want to be invested in this aggregate portfolio? You would say, no way. I would never do that. And that's where a good investment advisor can take a look at everything and say, I know what you're trying to do here because you've told me, and I can actually see your efforts. But you know what? You're not making a souffle here. You're making pudding, and you don't like pudding. And that's what ends up happening all the time.
Okay, let's take a quick break to digest this information and to welcome our new sponsor, Resultant, formerly known as KSM Consulting. They're one of our neighbors here on the beautiful Monument Circle, smack dab in the middle of Indianapolis. We'll be back in a moment.
The right data and technology solution can transform your business. KSM Consulting is now Resultant and still passionate about solving problems no one else can, still collaborating with our clients to find the best answer, not the easy answer. Visit resultant.com to see what's possible for your organization.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ podcast. Here's more of my conversation with Pete Dunn, aka Pete the Planner, about choosing a financial advisor.
Let me back up and say, I did like the sound of what you said before, which is, before we get into any questions about investment management, is just to do an in-depth examination of what I've got and what the strategy should be.
Well, okay, so here's the oversimplified way to think about that. Will the amount of money you have saved plus the amount of money you're consistently putting into that at an assumed rate of return help you reach your goals? And then there's other things sprinkled in there, like, hey, if you die, is your family taken care of? Hey, if your significant other gets disabled, are you taking it? Though that's all financial planning. So once that's established, once that question is yes or no, then you can say, okay, well, let's look what your ammunition is here. Let's look at, can you really get that assumed 8% rate of return with what you're dealing with? That's the delineation as far as I'm concerned. That's why it always starts with financial planning. However, because we are an instant gratification society, I don't know when we officially launched as an instant gratification society, but it's certainly as long as I've been alive.
It was 1922.
Okay, good. Yes. Well, certainly it's as long as I've been alive. The idea there is that people want to start with the sexiest stuff, which is investing. I mean, people hate talking about life insurance. I think you and I have talked about life insurance on this show before, but in terms of a financial plan, it is more apropos to the outcome than the investments themselves at the beginning of a conversation. But who in the world wants to have that conversation?
What I've found, maybe this is a consequence of my mindset, which is I've got to figure out something to do with these investments. I end up talking to a portfolio manager who says they can also do financial planning. And then the way that the fee for those services is explained is, you know, you get my complete attention and all of my acumen for every financial question you might have by paying 1% annually of your investments under management.
In the financial planning / investment management industry loves to make the compensation conversation revolve around commissions versus fee-based advice. And that commissions are bad and fee-based advice is ethical. Like that's the red herring here. The reality is it's so nebulous and it's so misrepresentative of the true ethics involved that you can't just say, well, fee-based planning is the better way. I don't actually agree with that. I'm not here to say that I think commission-based is better. I'm just thinking it's just not that binary. And in fact, even though I've done both. When I was a financial advisor, I was at one point primarily commission-based. Another point, I was more fee-based. And I can't really say whether my behavior as the advisor was different, but I can say the behavior of my clients was certainly different. Like how they interacted with me and their willingness to accept my advice without too much skepticism. I think the other element here too, it just seems incredibly insincere for someone to do a free financial plan for you, which could take, you know, 8 to 10 hours if they're doing it well, and not charge you because, well, theoretically they're overcharging you for managing your portfolio. Like, that's really frustrating. Like, that's incredibly frustrating. And so I get why you're frustrated.
Is the value of, you know, having, you know, an active, I assume a relatively active portfolio manager worth 1% of the value of the portfolio every year?
Okay. So here's the thing. If you can beat your returns that you would have done yourself by more than 1%, then obviously the advisor pays for themselves. And I think in most situations, an advisor can pay for themselves. That's, I mean, maybe I should have started there. The idea of that I think most advisors can deliver the value they promise. However, depending on what your strategy is and what the advisor comes in and says what you're going to do, if the advisor just comes put you in a bunch of index funds that mirror the S&P 500 and you know, tinkers a little bit here and there and doesn't necessarily hold you accountable to putting more money into the account, which is the best thing you generally should do, then what is the value? Especially if they don't provide a financial plan. I don't know. I think advisors prevent mistakes too. And that's sort of a hard thing to prove that, you know, if you're freaking out, if it's last March 23rd and the market's down 34% since February 19th, and you're like, I'm freaking out, Sally, I'm going to sell. And Sally tells you not to sell. Then she is worth her weight in gold. And so that's worth accounting for as well.
Well, yeah. And that is another common selling point that I've heard from advisors is when the shit hits the fan, I'm going to be right there, you know, with several buckets bailing you out. And you know, number one, you know, we're going to be able to see, you know, some of this ahead of time, and we're going to be actively, you know, putting you in safe places when it looks like there's a storm coming. And then when the storm comes, you know, you're not going to have a lot of exposure to stuff that, you know, is really going to hurt you. We can mitigate your losses.
You got most of the way there, and then maybe your last phrase took it to a strange place, right? So I remember the first financial crisis I went through as a financial advisor, the first market crisis. I was sitting in my bedroom at home, just dialing as fast as I could, calling through my clients. My now late pug was sitting on my back of the chair, resting his chin on my shoulder. And I was just calling. He's like, hey, it's going to be okay. We're going to make it. You know, I'm just trying to assure people that things are fine. The next financial crisis that came, I didn't bother to call my clients, because as I started to call them, like, yeah, I know. You told us last time. We're fine. Right? So it's like this idea of like, okay, so what you said is true. Their job is to, you know, set the tone of what happens. And ideally, portfolio construction mitigates some of the challenges that come with that, but they don't necessarily mitigate it in the moment, right? It's not like they're going to make systemic changes to your portfolio when it hits the fan that would save the day. It's really the initial investment strategy, and it's, again, setting the tone for how you choose to invest. They never indemnify you. I mean, they absolutely don't, unless you're dealing with an annuity through an insurance company. There is no indemnification. And by the way, even if your portfolio tanks 20%, your advisor is still getting paid. Their compensation doesn't go away. It just takes a 20% hit.
Are there other options for good investment management besides paying 1% of the value of your invested assets?
In terms of investment management, yes. And yes, 1% is the standard fee for a lot of, sometimes I call them flesh investment advisors as opposed to robo investment advisors. But then I realize in the moment how creepy that sounds. And then I'm like, oh, I hope they edit that.
I thought you were like going with like a Shakespearean reference to a pound of flesh.
I could. My wife is sort of the educated one in our relationship, so I play a different role. Okay. There are a lot of advisors that do it for a lot less than 1%. I mean, you'll see people more at 75 basis points and south of that, depending on how much you have invested. But at $500,000, I think you typically are going to be around that 1% mark, if not higher for some people. But yeah, there are some automated solutions that can do it for a lot less, that are based on modern portfolio theory, that are constructed using algorithms and all sorts of things. And instead of being at 1%, Mason, you can very easily be at 15 basis points or up to 0.25%, which over time, that's a pretty big difference. You don't get free financial planning services out of it, but that's a pretty big difference.
But again, I'm somebody who has a lot of pre-existing financial vehicles. The robo advisor isn't going to tell me what to do with my existing investments.
Yeah, no, they're going to say, hey, your recipes are not as good as our recipes. Your ingredients are antiquated. Let's switch you all completely out. And hey, some people need that.
A robot will try to sell me on buying something different by selling my current investments?
Well, I mean, robo-advisor describes the level of service that's really automated investing within different types of portfolios. And yes, it is automated, right? But there's not like, you know, Watson is not sitting there, analyzing your portfolio.
Really? Because I would trust Watson.
Now, it's funny. There are different investment services and things that do use things like Watson technology, you know, from IBM to like analyze your portfolio. But I think what you're looking for is for an algorithm of some sort or some AI to look at your portfolio and make changes around it. I'm not sure that's a thing quite yet.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm too old. I don't want anything automated. Even the person I may be dealing with may be using the automated stuff, I'd rather deal with a person.
You know, the weird thing is we convince ourselves that our investing preferences are a matter of personal taste, right? I mean, like we do. Just like, you know, my wife is mortified that when I was in college, I would keep Easy Cheese in my dorm room. Right? I mean, because, you know, Easy Cheese is like canned cheese. You press the top, it goes. That's the perfect sound for anyone's at it. Yeah. She's mortified that was my personal taste. And no offense to whoever makes Easy Cheese, probably Kraft or somebody. It's a horrible product that I happen to like, right? Sometimes with investing, your personal preference is a personal preference for a terrible investment. And so I know you're saying, well, hey, I'm older, I'm set my ways of how this. It is still remotely possible that what you love and what you're comfortable with is absolutely wretched. And so that is that advantage advisors, like advantage ethical advisor who can help you figure that out. And if anything out of this conversation is going to torture you, it's this idea.
Yes, I'm waiting for that to hit me as soon as I hang up. So how do I find the right financial planner?
I love this
investment
question.
Advisor or slash financial advisor who can help me get the 30,000 foot view and then plot the correct direction.
All right. So I think you start with making a list of 3 to 5 people that you are going to choose to interview to be your advisor. And part of that process is even before sitting down with them is 2 things. 1, populating the list. Like, how do you do that? Oftentimes with friends or coworkers who might be in a similar or better position than you, asking them sort of critical yet appropriate questions about their experience. And then upon populating that list of those 4 or 5 advisors, calling them or emailing them, whatever your preference of communication is, and being very blunt with them. Say, look, this is something I have struggled with for years, and I'm trying to find a good personality match, a good compensation structure that makes sense for me. Here's what I think I need, but I'm definitely open for you using your expertise to tell me what I need too. Do you take interview/first appointments in these situations? What you'll find is if you call 4 or 5 people with this idea, at least one of them will be like, that's not really my thing, which is great. Fantastic. You just saved yourself a lot of time by being honest and being transparent. I think, Mason, is that sometimes because you or someone else is so skeptical of the dynamics and because of what has happened in the past, that you do yourself a disservice by holding your cards too close to the vest, and then you end up putting yourself in a really weird situation. So that's where you begin. And then at the appointment, you get into the obvious things. It's like, hey, tell me how financial planning and investment advice are different here. Like, tell me about the different dynamics. And then you get into the compensation structure. And then expectations around communication, I think, is often the forgotten idea here. An advisor should ask you how often you want to talk to them. If they don't, you should say, well, how often do you plan on talking to me? And then they will inevitably give you a throwaway answer like, well, however much you want. But a good advisor would ask you that up front. And from there, it's just a relationship, like any other relationship, any other trusted. You go to a particular restaurant because you like that restaurant. You trust the management of the restaurant, the servers, the chef, and that relationship develops over time. And occasionally, you have a bad meal there. You don't leave a crappy Yelp review, by the way. You just are like, hey, it's part of the relationship, and you might tell them. Same thing with financial advisors. You can't just throw them under the bus the second it doesn't go very well. It's a professional relationship.
So obviously, I think as we've discussed, and I think you intuited, yeah, I have a lot of anxiety around the investment management side of it. So it sounds like I want to make sure that whoever I'm dealing with, if need be, can just handle that first part of it, getting a complete sort of financial map together.
Yeah, the other element we have not talked about here, which again is the next 2 hours of this very special IBJ podcast with Mason King, is how your significant other feels about all of this, right? I mean, it might be your domestic chore to deal with this part of your life. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I know in our house, we split different duties. I happen to deal with this, but Mrs. Planner's involved with this stuff as it relates to the guidance we get from an advisor, because I'm going to die first. Look at me. I mean, yeah, I look better, but you should see her. Like, so she's going to have to deal with our person. And you know, the gender dynamics and relationship dynamics of an advisor that can serve both people with in a relationship is, oh, it's vital. It is vital. You ask 10 women how many times they've been talked down to by a financial advisor when they go with their partner, 8 of them will say absolutely. So your wife's intuition in your particular situation, your wife's intuition about that relationship is as important, if not more important, than your own.
Thank you for bringing up my wife, because yeah, she adds a different layer to this conversation, in that she is not wild with some of the investments that I brought to the table. I mean, specifically, you know, that they are not socially or environmentally, you know, proper stewards of society or the earth. She and I kind of have to agree with her. I mean, it's true. Unfortunately, they pay really good dividends. But yeah, I'm totally open to divesting in a few things for sure, just because you just feel like, you know, that's not the kind of business I want to be in.
I'm with you. I mean, this coming from my first investment ever when I was in middle school, a friend's dad helped me buy tobacco stocks, which I did quite well on. However, I think looking back now as a 43-year-old man, I'm not sure I would invest in tobacco stocks.
Okay. Well, I feel like I know one thing that I can do.
Hey, that's enough. Here's the thing. I'm trying to simplify this. If you came out of here with seven things, you're not going to do any of them. You're here to do one.
Well, that's good. That really helps. Just to make myself accountable, I'll report back next time we talk and I'll let you know what we did.
I'll love it. Well, I'll make sure we have your address and we'll send you an invoice.
I was afraid of that. I was so afraid. I'll talk with you later.
See you, buddy.
My thanks again to Pete Dunn. And just a reminder, his column on personal finance appears regularly in the print edition of IBJ, and you can find several years worth of his work at IBJ.com. And before you get on with the rest of your week, there are a few stories in the latest print edition of IBJ I'd like to point out. The big draw, of course, is IBJ's 40 Under 40, the class of 2021, featuring a wide variety of young leaders. Over the more than two dozen years we've been compiling 40 Under 40, we like to think that we've built in enough flexibility to reflect changing business trends and priorities and definitions of success. The traditional constituencies of C-suiters still get their due this year, but the class of 2021, I think, demonstrates the increased importance of data, of diversity, of communications, and of social responsibility. Also in this week's issue, John Russell reports that a powerful activist investor has trained his sights on the parent company of Duke Energy Indiana, proposing that the parent utility be broken into three separate firms. And Mickey Shuey explains how the Capital Improvement Board of Marion County, which owns several of the city's largest sports venues, is working to rebalance its budget and rebuild its reserves after a year in which it fell $40 million into the red. Again, you can find these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at IBJ.com. I will say it is quite a bit easier to access all of the latest local news about business and politics and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbenner. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.